Here's a prediction. It comes from Andrew Keane. You might know him as an analyst of digital culture and as the author of the influential books The Internet Is Not the Answer and How to Fix the Future. He was speaking to Steve Austin on ABC Radio in Brisbane recently, and he was asked about Russian interference in other countries' elections and also the recent Facebook data scandal. Here's what he said.
I'm not convinced this Facebook Cambridge Analytica thing is the Chernobyl of data. It's not the big crisis. My sense is this is going to come later, maybe with a foreign government. Now, let's imagine that the Chinese government focused on aggregating data about every US citizen. With their resources, with their technological sophistication, with their access to capital, they could probably aggregate a million data points on every US citizen. That's the kind of crisis that's coming. It's not going to be Cambridge Analytica. It's not even going to be Facebook. It's going to be a foreign government. You in Australia are already familiar with some of the scandals associated with data and propaganda connected with the Chinese and familiar with the work of Clive Hamilton. That is going to be the big story in the next few years. So this is just the beginning. This is a tremor. Putin has done a very good job financing organizations and networks that undermine all our beliefs in democracy, fairness. He's financing racist groups all over Europe and the US. It is very worrying. What I would say, though, is that Putin is an annoyance. He's a big fly buzzing around, but China is the real threat on the horizon. And when they do hacking, when they do trollery, they will do it much more effectively, much more efficiently than Putin.
Andrew Keane, issuing a bit of a wake-up call there about what might be to come under the Chinese political leadership of Xi Jinping, who only this year had himself installed as dictator for life. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense.
We will implement the new development principles to support Chinese economy.
The Chinese Communist Party machine has clear ambitions to dominate in international affairs through economic, political, and even military means, and they're now being increasingly open about those ambitions. In just the past few weeks alone, the Chinese government has deployed missiles to the disputed Spratly Islands. Its navy has challenged Australian ships transiting the international waters of the South China Sea. Its officials have pressured Qantas and other international airlines, demanding they comply with the Communist Party's naming protocol for Taiwan and Hong Kong. And even Beijing's role in directly sponsoring Mandarin classes in Australia has now come in for scrutiny. Last week, the New South Wales state government announced a review of the Confucius Classroom Initiative after it was revealed that teaching assistants appointed by the Chinese Communist Party have been working in Australian public schools. Australian academic Clive Hamilton has been following all of these developments and more. He's the author of the book Silent Invasion: China's Influence in Australia. Professor Hamilton, welcome to Future Tense.
Pleasure to be here.
An increasing number of people are now warning about the concerted efforts being made by the Chinese Communist Party to force its worldview on the world and on other countries and to influence the political affairs of other nations. But you argue, don't you, that Australia and New Zealand are particularly vulnerable, that both countries are seen by Beijing as soft targets. Why is that?
Yeah, well, it became apparent writing the book that Beijing sees Australia and New Zealand as the weak links in the Western alliance. And I think there are a number of reasons why they've targeted Australia particularly. One is that we are a small to medium-sized country with a heavy trade and increasingly investment dependence on China, which gives them great economic leverage over us. And that means that there are a large number of influential people personally locked into a position of not upsetting Beijing. The second reason, I think, is the large Chinese diaspora in Australia, some 1.3 million people, or close to 5% of the population, which Beijing believes it can mobilise to serve its interests. Communist Party of China believes that if you have a Chinese face, it owns you. Simple as that, no matter what your citizenship is. And so it expects of people of Chinese heritage in Australia that their first loyalty will be to the motherland. And I think really important, if the more difficult to pin down factor, and that is Australia's open multicultural society, you know, our lack of suspicion, our lack of heavy securitisation of our society, as you find if you go to Beijing, incidentally. And so there are many more opportunities for influence and infiltration. And so, for example, and in particular, Chinese language media in Australia, newspapers and radio stations, are now, in contrast to 10 or 15 years ago, almost wholly owned, operated by pro-Beijing interests. And on social media, especially important for young people of Chinese heritage in Australia, the Communist Party's vast censorship apparatus now censors social media in Australia. So in other words, Australian citizens are having their communications censored in Beijing.
Now, I want to come back to the Chinese diaspora in Australia in just a few minutes, but you believe Beijing is really playing the long game here and that their ultimate aim is to break our alliance with the United States.
That's its ultimate aim, yes. I mean, Beijing sees itself as the dominant hegemonic power in the Asia-Pacific region. We're in that region. Therefore, we ought to be broken away from the US alliance, which would be an enormous strategic victory for Beijing, but that's what it wants to do. Australia is a European country in Asia, which Beijing sees as its sphere of influence. And we might think that's kind of a difficult task for Beijing to achieve, but if you look around and see the number of very influential Australian voices calling for Australia to adopt an independent foreign policy, you can see that should those voices prevail, then Beijing will be halfway towards achieving its ambition.
Now, you've just returned from the US. The Americans, at least, certainly take your message seriously, don't they?
Well, it was fascinating. I spent a week in Washington, and when my publisher, original publisher, Allen and Unwin, dropped the book, Silent Invasion, in November, it was a news story around the world as yet another instance, and a particularly striking one, of Beijing's influence, because Allen and Unwin said they were afraid of retribution from Beijing should they publish it. And they took special note of it in the United States. And so I discovered in that visit to Washington that although Russia dominates the headlines, many people understand that the People's Republic of China is the real long-term threat. I mean, here's a factoid which I think says it all in a way. Russia's GDP stands at $1.3 trillion, which is the same as Australia's. China's GDP by 2030 will be substantially higher than that of the United States. So my book, which is the first detailed analysis of the PRC's influence operations, attracted a great deal of interest in Washington and led to a whole bunch of lectures that I gave and conversations I had with State Department, intelligence agencies, think tanks, journalists, and so on. And of course, I was invited to testify before the Congressional Executive Commission on China, that is the ongoing congressional inquiry into China that's been supercharged by the chairmanship of Senator Marco Rubio.
One of the eye-opening things for me in reading your book is the level of Chinese economic patronage that already exists in Australian politics. Some of that's been covered by the ABC, I should mention, in the last couple of years. But that patronage that you write about and detail is directed to both the left and the right of Australian politics, isn't it?
Well, that's the fascinating thing. I mean, this is not a partisan issue. And we've seen in the last week Hillary Clinton in Australia and New Zealand making the same kinds of warnings that Senator Rubio, Republican, a fairly conservative Republican, has been making about China's growing influence and urging us to resist that. And similarly in Australia, I mean, Beijing is really quite eclectic in its political tastes. It doesn't, you know, it wants to influence politics across the board, no matter who is in government. And this is where it's crucially different from Putin. I mean, Putin has a short-term agenda, payback against Hillary Clinton, help get Donald Trump elected. But beyond that, there's kind of nothing. Whereas Beijing wants long-term influence no matter who the government is. We saw its influence operations through donations to political parties blow up in its face, as it were, in 2016 with the Dastyari affair. The stories, many of these broken by the ABC, as you say, the story about ASIO chief Duncan Lewis warning chiefs of the main political parties not to take donations from two prominent Chinese-Australian donors, that's Huang Zhengmo and Chow Chak Wing, because of their suspected links to the Communist Party. And so I think we've seen already that the political parties are being more wary about taking donations from billionaires with Beijing connections. But that's only a part of it. And it's kind of obvious part, but there are less obvious things going on. For example, there's now a string of people with clear Beijing connections through the United Front Network entering into politics, often at state government levels, or working in ministers' offices or politicians' offices, people who clearly have links to pro-Beijing organisations in Australia and are in all likelihood reporting back to the Sydney or the Melbourne or the Perth consulate. So this is another thing that I'm sure ASIO is keeping an eye on this, but it really hasn't come much to public attention. And yet there we have our political leaders, I think naively, opening themselves up to this kind of infiltration.
And your research in this area has been mirrored, hasn't it, by a study released late last year in New Zealand by noted China expert Professor Anne-Marie Brady.
Yes, Professor Brady really deserves a great deal of praise for the stance that she's taken. She's kind of my counterpart, as it were, in New Zealand. But the difference is that she's virtually alone, whereas I've had plenty of support in Australia. So she's really suffered as a result of it with some burglaries of her home and her office. But yes, yeah, she identified, and news outlets took up the story, a Chinese-New Zealand politician who had spent many years teaching English to Chinese intelligence officers and apparently still maintained links with the Chinese intelligence services. And when this was uncovered and reported in the New Zealand media, perhaps the most disturbing but also revelatory aspect of this is that senior politicians said, well, so what? He's a New Zealand citizen now, he was elected. What I think that betrays is a kind of profound innocence on the part of the political system in New Zealand and in Australia about the nature of Beijing's interference and influence operations.
Australia is part of the Five Eyes security bloc. Two other members, Canada and the US, have also had their own issues with Chinese covert political influence. What can we learn from their experience?
I think rather than us learning from them, they're looking to learn from us. It's seen around the world that Australia has really been at the forefront of these influence operations. But also, I'm glad to say, Australia is pushing back. We're the first to do it. We're only at the start of a process. And that's why there's keen interest in Australia's new foreign interference laws and the broader social shift in response to Beijing's interference.
This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. And our guest today is Australian academic, researcher and public intellectual Clive Hamilton, author of Silent Invasion, China's Influence in Australia. I mentioned the New South Wales government's review of the Confucius Classrooms program at the beginning of this show, but you've also detected worrying levels of Chinese government influence in our tertiary education sector as well, haven't you?
Well, it's something that grieves me in particular, being an academic myself, to watch the way in which Australia's universities have really been kowtowing to Beijing in order to protect particularly their revenue sources. Huge number of students from China paying full fees at Australian universities is proportionally some five times larger than in the United States. So it's massive. Not just student fees, but also our universities have literally hundreds of agreements with Chinese universities for research and teaching, which are also extremely lucrative. And my researcher Alex Joski and myself, uncovered also a network of research collaborations between Australian scientists, some of Chinese heritage, and scientists in China, some who work at military universities, who are doing research together in Australia on military-related matters. And we found this quite astonishing. And when we revealed it in a couple of newspaper articles last year, I think the sector itself was really quite shocked about this, particularly the Australian Research Council, which had been funding some of this military-related research, which was being funneled straight back into the military universities in China.
So have our universities then, have they compromised themselves?
Oh, completely. And the fact that they're hosting Confucius Institutes, which on the face of it is funded by the Hanban, which is an agency of the education department in Beijing, but which is in truth actually funded by the Communist Party's propaganda department. But the thing that kind of really struck me, Anthony, in all of this is when my book couldn't find a publisher. Alan Unwin pulled out. No Australian publisher would come along. Melbourne University Press was extremely interested, but then pulled out. No one, no university organisation, no senior professor or vice chancellor came out and said in public, this is a terrible attack on academic freedom in Australia. No one said anything. And I thought, why is this not a cause célèbre? I mean, this is the most serious attack on academic freedom in Australia for a long time. The publishing industry in Australia is afraid to publish a book critical of the Chinese Communist Party because they fear retaliation from the Communist Party. Does that mean no books can be published in Australia that are critical of the Chinese Communist Party? And yet none of them said a thing. I was shocked by that.
And just to be clear, when you talk about China and Beijing, you're talking about the Chinese Communist Party government and Xi Jinping. You're not talking about the Chinese people overall.
Absolutely. And I make this point over and over and over again in my book that we're talking about the Chinese Communist Party, or more broadly, the People's Republic of China, which, of course, the Chinese Communist Party is virtually identical with. And this is the thing that's so important for us to understand and to keep emphasising. Criticism of the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese state, is not a criticism of China. It is not a criticism of the Chinese people. And my critics, whether it's the Chinese embassy here in Australia or foreign affairs spokesperson in Beijing or a number of academics who've been critical of my book and people on the internet have been saying, oh, Hamilton's book is racist. It's an attack on all Chinese people. You know, I could not have done more in my book to try to avoid that criticism, not least by speaking to many members of the Chinese Australian community.
And in fact, you point out in your book that it's one of the strategies of the Chinese Communist Party, a strategy that many authoritarian dictatorships have adopted over the years, is to actually try and merge the sense of the people with the leadership. So, I mean, they deliberately try and blur that, don't they? So that if you do criticise them, they can paint it as a criticism of the Chinese people.
And it's been a deliberate strategy to do that since after the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, which really terrified the Communist Party leadership, and then a few months afterwards, the fall of the Soviet Union. And so what they did is they launched a so-called patriotic education campaign, which is pervasive throughout China, schools, everywhere. And the CCP went from being a Marxist internationalist party to one that overwhelmingly emphasised nationalism and the national humiliation of the Chinese people as a way of creating the view, very successfully, not least among some Western scholars, that the Chinese Communist Party is the proper legitimate representative of the Chinese people, and that therefore if you criticise the party, you criticise the people, and therefore you're probably racist, xenophobic, anti-China and all the rest.
And our guest today on Future Tense is Clive Hamilton. He's the author of Silent Invasion, China's Influence in Australia. Now, we've talked about the political influence in Australia and New Zealand. Your book also looks at the Chinese diaspora in Australia, as we mentioned, and the type of pressure that Beijing is deliberately putting on them. There's a quote in your book, which I wouldn't mind reading. It's from the Deputy Chief of the Overseas Chinese Affairs Office. And the quote is this: as the standing of overseas Chinese rises abroad and as their ethnic consciousness awakens, they will have the desire as well as the ability to collect their power in order to push forward the development and advancement of China. Now, the Chinese Communist Party's current attitude towards expatriate Chinese, that attitude that they should serve the will of Beijing, that's very different, though, isn't it, to the attitude that they had only a few decades ago?
Well, absolutely. And that quote reveals, and that's a very common view, in fact, that's the official view of the party, shows that it is, in fact, the Communist Party that adopts a racist standpoint because it defines the Chinese people in terms of their ethnicity and the obligations that go with ethnicity, the ethnic consciousness, as that spokesperson referred to it. And, of course, there are many Chinese Australians who object to that very strongly. I mean, they came to Australia to escape from the influence of the Chinese Communist Party and they remain Chinese people who are proud of their country's heritage, but they strongly reject the influence of the Chinese Communist Party in this country. And that's why many, not all by any means, but many Chinese Australians have been the greatest supporters of this book. And in fact, some 150 of them, or 130 more likely, came together to launch the book in Sydney at Parliament House. And it was a very touching event, actually. And the kind of message was, at last, the mainstream, through me, has come to acknowledge and to spell out what we have been saying about the Communist Party's influence in Australia.
But the Communist Party in China, its attitudes towards the Chinese diaspora were not positive ones a few decades ago, but they changed their mind because they saw that these people could be useful to them. Useful in what way? How exactly do they exert pressure on Chinese living in a country like Australia?
Well, it's a subtle, complex, or sometimes not so subtle, sometimes it's extremely brutal and coercive. If you're a Falun Gong practitioner, for example, in Australia, you'll find yourself coming under all kinds of very unpleasant pressure, including intimidation and punishment of your family back in China. If you're here in Australia as a Falun Gong practitioner, you can expect to be closely monitored, receive threatening phone calls. You won't be able to get a visa to go back and visit your dying mother. Basically, you'll be persecuted in your homeland. Other Chinese people in Australia, Chinese Australians, will be warned off against associating with you. But there are other much more subtle techniques, more carrot than stick for the broader Chinese Australian community through what is known as the United Front strategy. And the United Front is a very big department of the Chinese Communist Party whose objective is to win over, guide, control for its own purposes, the global Chinese diaspora of some 50, 60 million people. And it has a range of subtle psychological techniques to win elements of the Chinese diaspora over to its cause so that their loyalties lie first with Beijing and only second with Australia.
And the large number of foreign students who come to study in Australia from China, as the ABC has reported in the past, there have been instances, haven't there, in which they've been co-opted and coerced into publicly supporting Chinese government campaigns.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to distinguish between a couple of factors going on here. One is the Chinese student bodies on Australian campuses become increasingly drawn into, even if they don't want to be, a kind of network of Chinese student campaigning, if you like, through legitimate social activities and so on. But also, this is through the CSSAs, the Chinese Students and Scholars Association, which are set up by the embassy or the consulates on campuses and guided, financed by them. And the CSSA's purpose is to bring those Chinese students together to prevent them from spreading their wings, making friends beyond the Chinese community and so on, as a way of being controlled by the consulates, but also to make sure that individuals don't kind of deviate. They might want to go and listen to the Dalai Lama or read a book about the 1989 massacre or challenge, you know, the party's dominance in a tutorial. And if they do any of that, in all likelihood, they will be reported to the authorities. And there have been many instances where students who've done that kind of thing have received phone calls a week or two later from their parents back in China saying, we've had state security coming to visit us, telling us that you're getting into trouble in Australia and we want to make sure that you don't do anything that can create trouble. So please don't do these things. So there's a great deal of kind of coercion that goes on. But we should also remember that many of the Chinese students who come to Australia are very patriotic in themselves. They've come out of the patriotic education campaign from kindergarten through to university, and they do feel very proud of PRC's achievements. And so some of them are very happy to go along when, you know, Premier Li Keqiang or President Xi Jinping comes and cheer and wave Chinese flags.
Just listening to all of that, it seems almost unreal that this kind of covert influence campaign has been going on in Australia, and you're by no means the only one shining a spotlight on this. But it is surprising that Australians are so complacent about this, isn't it? If Russia was undertaking this sort of covert campaign, we'd be outraged.
As you say, we've been fascinated with Russian meddling because Putin is a Machiavellian character, he's linked to the Cold War, and what Russia is doing is so audacious. But China's influence is far more subtle and systematic and of course, is being carried out with a long-term objective in mind. And Beijing consistently uses an approach which is known as, in the vernacular, salami slicing, whether that's in the South China Sea or the United Nations or Australian politics. What it means is it cuts off a slice of the salami and kind of no one notices, or if people notice, it's not enough to really provoke a reaction. And then, of course, another slice is cut off. No one does anything. Another slice is cut off until they've got the whole salami. And so the Communist Party's influence and interference is deployed in Australia by a large and complex set of agencies. In Beijing, and I've done a kind of organisational chart for this United Front activity, each with its own tasks and using psychological techniques that have been developed and refined over many years. You know, we can be confused because we see official statements coming from Beijing, you know, that kind of old-fashioned Maoist rhetoric and the kind of hysterical tone, and we think, well, no one's going to take that seriously. Very misleading. Beneath that, there's a far more subtle and careful campaign of influence going on. And the way it works is that they persuade us in Australia, or rather Australian elites, to see the world as Beijing sees it and to act in ways conformable with Beijing's interests. And judging by the pro-Beijing commentary of so many senior figures in politics, in business, in universities, it's been very successful. There was a major commentator in the Financial Review today saying Julie Bishop should be sacked because she's upsetting people in Beijing. She should be over here being, you know, smarmy and diplomatic and soothing ruffled feathers, which is exactly how Beijing wants our foreign minister to be. But, and I think this is really crucial, Anthony, it's been highly effective over the last 10, 15 years in Australia. But in the last 12 to 18 months, things have shifted in Australia as a result of media reports, and I suspect in the case of the government intelligence reports, there's been a really marked shift, not only in the politics of it, in the Turnbull government and increasingly in the Labor Party, but also in broader society. The people have become concerned that something's going on and they don't like it. We've seen the Prime Minister Turnbull say Australia's going to stand up and he's introduced new laws to counter some of the forms of Beijing's interference. And I think in addition to him getting it as a result of intelligence reports and media reports and so on, it's also true that many Australians are anxious about it. And if politicians do not start responding to this and what Beijing's influence means for Australian values, democratic practice, and indeed our sovereignty as a nation, then they're going to suffer politically and Australia really will be sunk. I mean, if we don't really push back at this, bearing in mind that Beijing is now fighting back against this resistance, then we really are, if we don't resist it and make major steps forward in the next, say, 2 years, then we really are in trouble.
Clive Hamilton, author of Silent Invasion, China's Influence in Australia, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
And Professor Hamilton's book is published by Hardy Grant. On our website, you'll find a link to the research paper mentioned earlier in today's interview, the one written by Professor Anne-Marie Brady about Chinese political influence in New Zealand. And just a footnote to today's discussion, if you were wondering about the identity of the major commentator whom Professor Hamilton referred to just before, the one now calling for Australia's foreign minister to be sacked for apparently not being pro-Beijing enough, his name is Jeff Raby. He's a former Australian ambassador to China who now works as a businessman. Where? You guessed it, in the People's Republic of China. And finally, to show just how hardball the Chinese Communist Party can play, it's only been in this past week that Beijing has lifted an unofficial 8-month ban on senior Australian representatives visiting their country. The ban was imposed as a result of the sorts of revelations exposed by Clive Hamilton, the ABC and others. That's Future Tense for another week. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.